I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Do you happen to engage in some kind of meditation? There seem to be endless flavors of this practice called meditation, with all sorts of people willing to coach you in it. There's mindfulness meditation, movement meditation, mantra or transcendental or spiritual or focused meditation. There was a particularly stressful season in my life when I found a few practitioners on YouTube explaining their approaches and philosophies, and I tried a few out. But confession time, I have these certain tendencies to self-subvert. It's my deep inner skeptic. He pops out from time to time and says things like, Marcus, you think this is Zen, but maybe your Zen isn't quite as good as the Zen that you're seeing that sensei on YouTube experience. Or maybe, Marcus, you're arriving at Zen 1.0 and there's a better, newer release like 6.0 or 7.0. Maybe you should just shop around some more. That's kind of the way I've approached it. In the year 2012, Vanessa Potter was suddenly struck with a neurological disorder that caused sudden but temporary blindness and paralysis. She slowly regained sight and mobility, but the jolt to her life expectations and her professional possibilities, that was a big thing, to say the very least, quite a jolt. And her story of physical incapacity merged eventually with another story of a quest she undertook to understand the brain through what you could call a meditation discovery tour. Her discovery tour was much more methodic and more probing than my impatient consumer shopping around on YouTube for the right sensei. She tells her story in a couple of books. The first is titled Patient H69 and the second titled Finding My Right Mind. She's a former broadcast producer turned civic scientist. Vanessa Potter, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Were you ever a skeptic about meditation? Let's get that straight right now.
Oh, man, completely. Absolutely. I was the classic eye roller. I'd dabbled in meditation, probably since about 2008, and been to a Buddhist retreat and kind of loved the idea, but just did not get into any kind of practice. But it's interesting about that skepticism. Even if you are skeptic and you're putting yourself out there and exposing yourself, it goes in. And that's what I was really surprised about how much of it had actually sunk in. But yes, total skeptic to begin with.
So you know what it feels like to be sitting there going through either moves or thoughts or patterns of whatever you're supposed to do, and you feel like, I'm an idiot. Have you had that feeling?
And have that regularly. I think one of the misconceptions about a meditation practice is that you're not supposed to feel any of those things. And actually, it's not about clearing the mind. It's not about emptying the mind. It's not about being perfect. You know, you can't really do meditation well or badly. The point is just doing it. Of course, there are, you know, some nice side effects. You do tend to get more fluid and more practiced. And for me now, I can sit in a meditation practice and within a couple of minutes, you know, reach a fairly relaxed state. But I absolutely have times where I still, you know, rattle on shopping lists. But I don't give myself such a hard time anymore. I've kind of learned that through doing all these different practices. And they all say that, you know, we are so hard on ourselves in our modern busy lives. And I think the one time we can maybe not be quite so hard on ourselves is when we're doing some meditation.
Yeah. It's kind of like cutting yourself a little bit of slack and just saying it's okay not to be not to have those expectations, whatever they are, either self-imposed or externally imposed.
Absolutely. Totally. Yeah. It's time out. It's time out for your brain. It's time out for your body. It's an opportunity to just settle and connect with your senses, which we don't do. We fly so fast. And if you just get, you know, the sense that you've got a body in your session, then that's really great.
I love that phrase, connect with our senses, because that leads to the sense of sight, of vision, and the story of your blindness. Were you given to consider meditation before that event? Was it during that event, after that event? When did meditation become important to you in a big way relative to losing your sight?
So when I had my illness, when I lost my sight, which actually went over the course of 72 hours, it kind of just faded really quickly. I had an 18-month-old child. I also had a 4-year-old. And I'd used hypnobirthing for both of those births. And so I'd been taught self-hypnosis and visualization, and also some relaxation tools. I'd been taught yogic breathing, which is very simply breathing in for about a count of 4 and out for 8. So I had some tools, if you like, in my mental kit bag. I didn't particularly think about them and I didn't use them on a daily basis. But when I went blind, they became my... They kind of became my salvation. They absolutely saved my mind. And I didn't really consciously go, oh, this isn't great. You know, I can't feel my hands and feet and I can't see. What shall I do? My body just took over. And that was what inspired me to go and, you know, investigate and become curious about the mind, because I kind of feel like I didn't do it. My mind, my body took over and just ransacked these tools and started using them. So I started using visualization in the hospital as I was going blind. I was trying to find a mental sanctuary, and that's what visualization can be. It can be where you imagine a really beautiful, safe, lovely, calm place. And for me, that was a beach, and it's a beach I'd used throughout all my pregnancies. So I knew this beach, if you like, invented inside my mind. And I would just go and take myself to this beach, and I would breathe very slowly and calmly, and I would regulate my nervous system. I mean, I didn't know I was doing that, but it was this incredible resource that, you know, no one gave me in a bottle. It was inside my head, and I used it constantly from those very first moments.
So I've just closed my eyes and I'm trying to visualize a beach, and I want to visualize the beach that you visualized. Can you depict that for us?
Oh, that feels really weird when you ask that, because this is the wonderful thing about visualization. It's such a personal thing. And actually, as I'm talking about it, and every time I do talk about it, it pings into my mind's eye. So my beach is a wide expanse. It's white sand, which is actually quite hot to the touch. But I know on my beach, one of the lovely things I can do is scrunch my toes underneath that hot sand and have that lovely cool sand underneath. I also have very beautiful, very cliched perhaps, beautiful blue waves, and they crash and roll. And so I've got the sound of that. I've got the movement of waves. It was quite important for me to be multi-sensory, so I could kind of imagine hearing, imagine seeing. That means I've got all, I'm basically, when I was blind, what that was doing was firing up all my visual centers and keeping them functioning, because that is where we see inside the mind. It's not the lenses in our eyes. It's a cognitive, it's a brain thing. So yeah, so I have this beautiful beach, and I have different things happen. I have seagulls fly past. I stand on the beach and just feel the sun. And sometimes I walk into the water. I might, you know, feel the waves lapping around my ankles, and it's very visceral. I mean, I really do feel it.
Oh. Now, is this a real place, or is it entirely your imagination?
It's a mishmash of memories, imagination, all sorts. Yeah, it doesn't exist. But it does in a sort of mental way, if you like.
Yeah. Well, okay. So here you are with a condition not yet diagnosed. This is a mystery illness, and you've got doctors tending to you. And if you happen to be the type of person with a temperament to solve problems, I'm just assuming that you were, you know, you worked in broadcast production, you're solving problems all the time, and you got to get down to, you know, brass tacks. Were you driven to solve this with your doctors? How did you cope?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. As a TV producer, you're taught to be a problem solver and you're always thinking in advance. So I totally went into producer mode, and I started documenting this whole experience for that very reason. And I think partly, you know, sort of diving into this visualization and the breathing techniques was part of that problem solving. I kind of wanted to control it and to fix myself. And in fact, all the things I did when I went home, I was sent home legally blind and having to learn to walk using sticks. I just completely produced my entire recovery. It was very organized. I had tests and measures. I set up experiments because I was just determined. When I left hospital, no one could tell me anything. They wouldn't even tell me if they thought I would see again or walk again. It was kind of up to me. And so I suppose I took that and went, right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get my vision back, my mobility back. And I haven't really got a plan, but I've got some ideas and I just did them. And as I say, documented all of it. It sounds crazy when I look back, but I was on such a mission and it was very successful.
How much recovery have you had?
Physically, completely. I'm completely recovered. I mean, I started off, you know, not being able to even stand. And then I built up walking, you know, 10 paces, 30 paces, 50 paces, and just built it up that way. And I'm partially sighted. I haven't got all my vision back. I have low color. And it kind of feels like looking through a dirty windshield or maybe through like a muslin sheet. It's like an interference that I look through, but otherwise I function as anybody else.
Yeah. And was there ever an ascertainment of the cause? Did anybody ever figure it out?
Not really. I have a diagnosis of NMOSD, which is an autoimmune neurological illness and extremely rare. I mean, one of the things is I had to kind of let go of that and allow it to be unknown. And I'm kind of okay with that, just as long as it never happens again.
So the letting go that you just said, that converges with a lot of approaches to meditation, too, that I've heard about, the idea that this whole control issue, that you have to go into a space where you're not quite so married to all the problem solving you want to do, that you're inclined to do, that you feel is urgent.
Totally. And it was part of my kind of personality. So it's been quite hard to unravel that. But then you kind of stand back from, you go, well, how am I helping myself? You know, if I'm hanging on to, let's say, you know, hoping for a miracle or needing to understand, you know, what caused this, then we don't have that facility. We know a lot about brains and about neurological illnesses, but we don't know everything. So, and it's not an instant thing either. It's taken several years to really slowly and to genuinely accept it. So not just actually say that out loud, but actually to really work on that and feel that. And that's certainly been one of the byproducts of doing the amount of meditation that I've done. It's like anything, you kind of get better at acceptance. You get better at learning to let go. You get better at recognizing when you're holding on, perhaps is another way of looking at it. And when that happens, you can. And the other thing is, you don't have to let go all in one go. You can just do it gradually. You know, there's no rules around this. So I've learned to do it slowly in my own time and come to a place where I can kind of stop and go, okay.
Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Vanessa Potter with us. She's author of Finding My Right Mind. We're going to be talking about this meditation discovery tour that she undertook. And by the way, this was not a quick, brief tour. It lasted a couple of years and was very methodic. Vanessa, did you say from the get-go, well, I'm going to do what a journalist might do. I'm going to investigate what's available. I'm going to size it up and learn about it and document it.
Absolutely. I think that's a good analogy. And I was kind of part journalist, part TV producer in that, you know, investigative mind and the kind of terrier instinct to get, you know, into a subject. And I was also quite scientific about it because, of course, I was working with neuroscientists at Cambridge University. So I was extremely organized, methodical. And it was also really important that whilst I suppose, you know, each modality, each meditation technique, it's a snapshot, but it was an immersive snapshot. So I spent between 8 and 12 weeks practicing each technique every single day with a teacher. So I really got into it enough to be able to understand it and of course, record my brain frequencies, which was what I was doing for the scientists. I was wearing this crazy EEG headset, which looks like a prop from a sci-fi movie. It's not attractive.
So you actually, you did this with every single modality of meditation. You were being measured. Your brain waves were being observed.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours. And I sat at home with it on my head. I've actually been out in public sometimes for walking meditations, wearing it under a hat. And I have, been a human guinea pig and recorded my brain while I went through these 12, 13 different modalities so that the scientist, and I also did more than that. So I would wear the EEG headset, but I would also record my own subjective observations. And I was recording that in a very, very scientific and methodical way through an app. It was actually quite a lot of admin.
Well, was this your project or their project?
It was a combination of the two. I worked with Barbara Jacks as part of her PhD subject in Tristan Bekenstein's lab at Cambridge University. And we were looking at the differences between different meditation modalities. But what we were looking at was how my brain behaved during each modality. We were just measuring what it did rather than, you know, why it did it. And we were looking at different ways of recording that subjectively. So we got a continuous measurement of each modality rather than like, what did you feel before and afterwards? We got the experience during the modality.
Okay, let's talk about some names for modalities. Which different flavors were there?
Oh, gosh. Well, I started at mindfulness. I've done transcendental meditations. I've done mantra-based meditations, compassion, kundalini yoga, vipassana. Gosh, sometimes I forget the list. Hypnosis. We put that in there whilst it's not formally a meditation. Visualization and hypnosis, there's a lot of intersections between the two. And if we're looking at mind training, which we were, then that's very relevant. I also did Christian meditation. That was a really interesting one. So, and breath work. And I ended with psychedelics.
Oh, my. Yeah. You were a guinea pig.
Yeah.
Okay. What about the aspect of the observation? There's this Heisenberg principle thing going on where when you observe something, the nature of the thing is changed, is altered by that observation itself. The fact that you're wearing this head device and that your brain waves are being measured, were you able to just like bracket that off and pretend that wasn't there?
That's a great question. And that was something I really had to work on very hard in the beginning, because it's like you suddenly put a camera lens and you point it back at yourself and yet you're trying to have an experience. And so weirdly, I did learn to be able to stand back and actually have the experience in as genuinely as you possibly can, but also sort of record it, you know, mentally be able to. So I trained myself to be able to do that. And all sorts of things happen. So I would be able to know exactly how many minutes I'd just meditated for. I got better at doing that. There were some times, though, I would have days where I go, right, you can't watch me today. I'm going to meditate without anyone watching me. So I absolutely had to do that sometimes, totally.
Well, imagine me with one of these devices on and I say to myself, no, I'm taking that off when I'm having private prayer. Could you understand that?
Totally. Yeah. And I was, and there's something strange as well, something very intimate about the scientists, recording my brain. And I would also record, I did lots of diaries. So they had what was happening in my life. But that, all added to the picture and has given, an incredible in-depth observation of not only these individual practices, but the accumulative effect upon them, upon me and upon my ability to train my mind. So there were moments where I did balk sometimes and go, oh my God, why am I sharing my brain with you? Why am I doing this? Why am I putting myself through this? Because it was really hard work. And some of the different meditation styles, were emotionally challenging. It was difficult. It was upsetting sometimes. I went through a whole rainbow of emotions, but I'm still, really grateful I did it, because coming through the other side, I have learned so much, not just about meditation, but about myself. And it's offered me the opportunity to have all those flavors, as you, a great way of describing meditation. And so I have a bespoke approach to it now. I know exactly what's right for me because I've explored it so much.
So if there's a common denominator among all of these different modalities, I've never thought about meditation modalities, but you use the word and it works for me, flavors. If there's a common denominator, see, I'm willing to believe that there's value to be derived from any number of these approaches. I'm not going to poo-poo any of them. I'm not going to say that I think they're good. But I'm always looking, like that consumer shopper, I'm looking for the best one, you know? And you say you know what's right for you, and you're clearly not going to prescribe the best for other people because you would want them to find what's best for them in the store that offers different varieties of meditation. But they're distinct from each other also in some ways, and I'm wondering if you could explore that with me.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Meditation is absolutely not one size fits all. And they are really very different. And that's whether you're focusing on compassion work, so a meditation like Buddhist loving kindness, which is a really specific kind of meditation where you are conjuring up, you know, feelings of love, and that can be really challenging and really difficult, but also incredibly rewarding. And that's really different from using a mantra, which I mean, I enjoyed them. And you're right that there's no one that I would ever poo-poo in any way, shape, or form. I got something out of every single modality, and quite different things. So, for example, Vipassana, which is a very intense form of meditation that you learn on a silent retreat where you are literally living in isolation for 10 days away from your family. I learned how to kind of deactivate my reactivity in a way that I did not think was possible. So, you know, they all offered quite different outcomes. And sometimes I wasn't surprised, and sometimes I was really surprised. If you want a common denominator running through all of them, though, I think for me, one of the most powerful was compassion work. And I expected this to be a bit fluffy and a bit like, I was like, what's the point? You know, why would I think nice, you know, lovely thoughts about people? What, you know, what's the point of that?
Okay, is that but what actually, you really do? You actually sit still and you visualize others and you kind of size up your feelings toward them, and you try to calibrate your feelings toward them?
In a way, loving kindness, I've come across lots of different styles, but the very kind of traditional style is you start with yourself and you just repeat affirmations, which could be, you know, may I be well, may I be happy. You kind of think, you know, look, can I just be okay? Is that all right? And you kind of, you try and this word gets used, cultivate in meditation, and you kind of grow, you kind of dig down deep and find those feelings of compassion for yourself. And actually, it's very common if you start a compassion practice to not be able to find those feelings, because so many of us are numbed. We're numbed by our busy lives, by trauma, by many, many different things.
Can we get a little autobiographical here for you? Are you one of those who had a difficult time expressing love, feeling?
Totally. Yeah.
Why?
Compassion was the breakthrough for me because, as I say, I approached it with this, ugh, you know, it's what's the point? But very quickly on, I realized how powerful this is. As I say, you start with yourself in this practice, but then you would move to other people. So you move to someone you're very close with and you go, may you be happy. And you picture this person in your mind. I mean, I pictured my children. And I suddenly had this horrible feeling. And I couldn't conjure up love for my children. And that was devastating. And that's also very, very common. And so I had to work on it. And I realized, because I was just skimming through life and traveling so fast, I'd never sat down and sat with loving feelings, which sounds so crazy, but we don't really, you know, visit those emotions. So I really did have to cultivate them. And once I did, it was just like the gates opened. And as you move through the practice, you then become compassionate towards people you're a bit ambivalent about, you know, maybe your local barista. And then you can do it towards people you don't like. That's interesting work. And then you do it towards the whole world. And for me, it became such an all-encompassing, powerful practice. My goodness, compassion work is so powerful. And it really changed my entire outlook on life, my family, me, everything. And then it segued and influenced, I would say, all the other practices I did after that.
Well, in your personal history, I want to point out that this compassion work was something that now you have a name for, but didn't you try a little compassion work when you were a teen?
No, I don't think I did. I don't think I was very nice to myself as a teenager, actually.
What was there not a time, though, when you wanted to say, I love you, but you found that difficult to say that to somebody?
Yeah, absolutely. I think like many teenagers, I didn't express how I felt. I found that difficult. I think, you know, all of those things get stored in the body, and the body has this memory, and particularly of the struggle. And so a lot of that comes out during a compassion practice. I used a sort of, you know, floodgate analogy. It really was. It was like somebody took the stopper out and all that stuff that maybe I'd never quite connected with. And of course, I'd been through a massive psychological trauma with my sight loss, and I felt like I'd been holding my breath. And so a lot of that all got released during that practice. And it was kind of a bit like therapy, I think, compassion work for me.
So let's talk about hypnosis a little bit more. You've mentioned it already, but there's opportunity to be in public, and that can be, you know, people have a little stage fright, and sometimes hypnosis is applied. Didn't that happen to you? I'm thinking about a speech at Cambridge University,
yes.
I think.
Well, yes, actually, the first time I used, hypnosis in a practical way was before I gave a TED talk in front of 1,000 people with 3 cameras in Belgium. And I used a hypnosis program before I went, because it wasn't the talking that was the problem. It was the sleeping the night before. So sleep is my Achilles heel. Like many people, I've suffered insomnia in bouts throughout my life. And hypnosis is absolutely what helps me. And I followed this program. I used a hypnosis track the night before. I probably had one of the best night's sleep ever. Before my talk, I skipped into the auditorium. I was chilled, relaxed. I was probably the calmest person there, and I was by far the least experienced speaker. And I absolutely loved every minute of that talk. And that was a complete polar opposite to how I'd felt 2 weeks before that. I was absolutely racked with nerves. I would have night sweats worrying about it. And there I was. And so that for me was the power of hypnosis. But I know about how powerful hypnosis is through my hypnobirthing with my children. So it works very, very well for me. So it had to be something that we investigated during the experiment.
Is it possible to take a meditation discovery tour and come to the way station called Christian Meditation and try to practice Christian meditation without being a believing Christian?
Yeah, and that was exactly the question I had when I went into that. So I did, Christian meditation. So it's, again, a mantra meditation. And so for me, it was a really interesting experience. And my church, my local church around the corner from where I live, were so embracing of this project and really supportive. And whilst I didn't necessarily leave the experience having an increased faith or feeling like I was, you know, a Christian particularly, I had a massive connection to my church and the community that the church creates. So I actually really, I got far more out of that experience than I ever expected. That chapter is actually quite, I'm told, is the really funny one, because when I go to church, I do try very hard to go to church and do everything right, and I do absolutely everything wrong. I just get I fell flat on my face. And I just thought, well, I've got to write about this. I've got to be honest. And I dragged my daughter along to a couple of the Sunday church sessions. And
can you explain what you mean by you did absolutely everything wrong? Oh, you know, you're talking about sins.
Yeah.
You're talking about murder or theft, or what are you talking about?
Oh, no. No, I mean, standing up at the wrong time, sitting down. There was a harvest festival. We didn't know. We hadn't brought anything with us. I just felt very confused because I've never been a regular churchgoer. My family weren't particularly churchgoers. And so I wasn't brought up knowing the rules and what to do when. And it's quite funny, is that chapter, because I got quite frustrated, because one of the things that I I was kind of cross about is I walked into church, you know, trying my best to join this and be part of it. And I didn't know what to do. And a church service is complicated. You know, you've got to get things in the right order. And actually, since then, I did talk to them, and they've put loads of information on the back of the leaflets when you come in now with what to do. And I think that's great, because the church really listened. They really listened, and they supported me in really beautiful ways, actually.
So are you experiencing, as an attendee, what your neighbor standing next to you or sitting next to you might be experiencing? Or is this a different appropriation of an outward practice for your inward meditation?
Well, I don't know. I couldn't speak on behalf of others. What was really interesting is that the Christian Meditation Group, and this is a form of meditation that was kind of devised by John Main using a mantra, encompasses Indian techniques. So it's not necessarily what you'd expect, you know, the Church of England to do, but they ran this meditation, Christian meditation group within the church. And so I would go to that group, and I stood next to that group, next to Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists. So actually, I felt very connected to the person standing next to me, because we were all there out of, for me, curiosity. I don't know why they were there particularly, but we were all there together. And I found it very interfaith. I liked the interfaith.
Well, this is fascinating, because so often we think of meditation as being something done in isolation, and you're pulling in a communal element.
Yeah, absolutely. There was totally a communal element. And I think lots of people were surprised by that. And you know, I had conversations with my local vicar where we were dissecting my experiences, and we were talking about faith, and we would talk about Buddhism as well, you know. And I think the more open we are about faith, and the more we can have those conversations, the better it is.
Have you become, I'm not going to say what kind of faith, but is there a way to talk about this? Are you a person of faith at some level, in some dimension?
You know, I always find that such a hard question. Probably the strict answer is no, not particularly. But I have, you know, I have a very strong meditation practice. And I suppose I think that's my faith now. It's not church-based, but funnily enough, I'm working on a project with my local church. So, you know, some doors were opened that were absolutely not there. And I feel like I can contact the church and you know, collaborate with them now in ways that I never did before.
So the title of this book, Finding My Right Mind, that first word, finding, it's not past tense. I want to say, I sure hope you found your right mind. Did you find your right mind?
Again, good question. I think I did. And I think it's one of the things that creeps up on you. I mean, you know, the book is a gateway. The idea is that, you know, you follow my experiences. It's a showing, not telling book. It's experiential. It's everything that happened to me, warts and all, because I wanted it to be relatable, so that, you know, if somebody did want to find their right mind, I think by reading my experiences, we all learn from each other. And so, yeah, I think I did. And what it is now is a hybrid. As I say, I've got a bespoke approach, and I just feel like I'm equipped. I feel like I have tools for life now, and they feel thought through and developed, and like they fit me. And that's very satisfying. And I didn't know if I was going to get that at the beginning of this crazy experiment.
Well, you know, what's not crazy about it is it takes some life experiences of many, many people, and it combines them with sort of a scientific observation. I understand you're also working on some citizen science project that involves what in Japan is called forest bathing, a rough translation. And once again, here you are taking tools of science and observation, trying to assess and analyze what a lot of people would consider to be kind of fluffy and subjective.
Absolutely. Yeah, my latest project is called Park Bathe, and it's exactly that, taking forest bathing, which the original term is Shinrin-yoku, and this is walking mindfully in nature, absorbing the atmosphere through the senses. But you do this in Japan for 2 or 3 hours in an ancient woodland, and who has that much time? So I worked with a health researcher at Derby University, and we've adapted it to be 1 hour in an urban green space. And we've just done our first round of walks, and we've got a load of stats and data in. Oh my goodness, it's so exciting because they are beyond our expectations.
So these people are walking in a park. Are they wearing the headset? Yeah.
No, actually they wear heart rate variability monitors. So we're recording their stress levels by using heart rate variability because that's a really good measure. And they also do a well-being survey before and after each walk. But they're just walking through their local park with us, but in a different way.
Well, I'm very encouraged and inclined to ward off my inner skeptic. I'm going to do some more exploration of my own and try to find my right mind too. Vanessa Potter, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you.
Oh, thank you so much for talking to me.
Vanessa Potter is author of Patient H69 and more recently, Finding My Right Mind.
Marcus Smith there. I'm Tenery Taylor. Meditation is good for your soul and your brain, but if you can get physical exercise and mental therapy, well, that's what I think we call a twofer. So why not? Next on Constant Wonder, we'll talk to a scientist about walking and meditating together. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Have you ever gone on a walk to clear your head? Well, Marcus Smith wanted to know more about the benefits of walking for the brain. So he reached out to Shane O'Mara, a professor of experimental brain research at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. He's also the author of In Praise of Walking, The New Science of How We Walk and Why It's Good for Us. Here's an excerpt from their conversation.
You got to move. The universal recommendation of every single health agency that has focused on this shows that diseases of non-communicable sedentary diseases rise as people become more sedentary. So these are kind of metabolic disorders like diabetes, cardiovascular disorders, but also disorders of or changes in personality. People's personality changes a little, they become a little bit more close-minded, they become a little bit more neurotic as they are sedentary, and they're at much more risk of psychiatric disorder like depression, which is a real plague in the modern world. And of course, they're storing up problems for later in life. You know, so standing up out of a chair at the age of 30 is not a big deal. But it is when you're 60, if you haven't been practicing it and you've lost all the muscle mass that should have been there because you were engaging in movement. And this is kind of the problem that we have. We've engineered it to make it easy for people to sit, but we haven't engineered it to make it easy for people just to default to movement. And to all intents and purposes, every level of movement above the most basic that you engage in is good for you.
Now, in American history, there are several figures we turn to when we want to talk up walking. There's Emerson, there's Thoreau, there's John Muir. Those are the standard go-to people when we want to really push for this. But there are others, artists. Beethoven was famous for his walking, and the philosopher Immanuel Kant took his walks. Talk to us, if you would, about creativity, ideas, and walking, the intersection there.
Yeah, so there's loads of kind of anecdotal stories about the power of walking for creativity. So Stephen King, the novelist, of course, is a great walker. And I give the story of Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, who, when he had writing to do, would go make a few points on a card, walk for an hour, and then come back and produce that wonderful prose that resulted in him being a philosopher getting the Nobel Prize for literature. So that, you know, that from that kind of point of view, there's lots and lots of anecdotal stories that walking some way facilitates creative thinking. So the kind of there's a lot of bits and pieces to unpack here. So let's talk about creativity itself just for a moment. A way of measuring creativity is to bring people to the lab and hand them common household objects. So this could be a writing pen, it could be a notebook, it could be a can of beans, it doesn't really matter. And you ask them to come up with as many alternative uses for these objects as they can over, let's say, the next 30 seconds, the next minute, something like that. And what you find is that some people are really good at doing this, and other people are not so good. So there's a variation in the number of ideas, alternative uses that people can come up with. Now, if you do something a little bit clever, and instead of just getting people to come in, sit down, wait, and then do the task, you get people to either walk for a number of minutes and then do the task, or just sit for a number of minutes and do the task. What you find is that people who have walked come up with about twice as many ideas compared with the people who've been sitting before they have to perform the task. And this is true irrespective of the type of movement. So you can walk outdoors or indoors, or you can walk on a treadmill. The movement is the thing. And it turns out also that this is a really good shortcut in people who are older. If you compare people in their early 20s to people who are in their early 70s, people who get up and walk typically generate about twice as many ideas as people who are seated in their 20s. So it's a kind of a hack to get your creative juices flowing when you're older. Now, the question is, why might this be the case? So what we know is that when you do brain scans on people who are engaged in creative idea production, they kind of flicker between two differing states. In one state, they're looking at the details. And then in another state, they flicker out and they're looking at the big picture. So it's kind of seeing the forest and then seeing the trees simultaneously. So they're engaging lots and lots of brain networks when they're doing this. And the kind of idea I have is that when you're up and about and you're moving, you're flickering between almost a mindful state where you're concentrating on the task and a mindless state where you're focused away from the task. But at the same time, because you're up and moving, you're activating widespread regions of the brain which you wouldn't otherwise be activating. When you're seated in your chair, your brain doesn't have a whole lot of work to do. It's obviously got to keep you alive, keep you breathing, doing all that kind of thing. But when you stand up, you have to maintain balance, and then you have to interact with the environment when you're walking. So much more of the brain is engaged in a much more powerful way than it would otherwise be the case. And we know that, for example, when you do studies of people, when you look at their ability to detect moving objects at the periphery of their eyes or the periphery of their vision, that they're better at this when they're walking around than when they're seated. So walking actually feeds back onto the brain itself and activates kind of the systems that are concerned with how you see the world, how you hear the world, all of that kind of thing, much more sharply than just merely being seated.
Whether it's very focused activity or kind of, you know, off to the, you know, peripheral, we're still processing where we are, where we're stepping, how we get from here to there, and all of the landmarks around us. Does that kind of visual stimulation within specific spaces somehow, does that translate into the kind of brain activity that pushes us towards creativity?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it, is the honest answer. So what we do know, I suspect, though, that you are correct, and I'd say it in for the following reason. So when you're moving about in the world, a key brain region that's activated is known as the hippocampal formation. And this part of the brain acts as your GPS system. So it tells you where you are. It represents the kind of goals that you want to get to. And it's the first place that gets damaged during Alzheimer's disease. And one of the cardinal features of Alzheimer's disease is a loss of spatial orientation. You don't know where you are in space, and you don't know where you are in time. You kind of lose the ability to tell one day from the next, one moment from the next. So you're living in this kind of permanent present tense, as it's sometimes referred to as. Now, it turns out that this part of the brain, which is involved in telling you where you are in space and giving you a mental timeline, is also critically involved in imagination. When you look at studies of people who have damage to this part of the brain, you ask them to, for example, imagine what a holiday will be like next year, or to tell you what they're planning to do next week. all the richness that the average person will be able to generate is lost, and their days, as they describe them to you, will be much the same, one like the other. So that kind of richness that you get in imagination is lost when you have damage to the part of the brain that's also concerned with your location in space and time. So these brain systems must perform a kind of a unified function. And I don't think we have a good account of how they do that yet, but at least we know that the same brain regions are responsible for these differing functions.
Walking doesn't need to be solitary. In fact, there's a social component where maybe our sociality is enhanced in some way with this activity called walking.
You know, we've got one verb for a whole variety of different things because they all happen to entrain our legs. And I think this is one of the kind of problems that we have with the language that we use to describe walking. So one thing I spend a lot of time thinking about in the book is so-called social walking. So a simple experience we've all had when we go for a walk is that if I'm long-legged and you're short-legged, unconsciously, I'll slow down a little and you'll pick up your speed a little so that we end up at the same speed. And if there's an obstruction on the path ahead of us, we'll both sashay in synchrony together around that object. So in other words, we're coordinating our behavior together without even thinking about it. And we'll do it in a way that allows us to remain kind of sufficiently glued or coupled to each other so that you can hear what I'm saying and I can hear what you're saying. And we'll be able to move together in a very reliable and regular kind of way. And just to give you a different example of this, so this is kind of social behavior in the wild. Now, a different example, of course, is if I was to put you in a brain scanner and I was to play you the sounds of footfalls, what you'll get is activity in the parts of the brain that are concerned with hearing, which is no surprise. It's a noise, and of course, these brain regions are going to come on. But we also have a major part of our brain, which is sometimes called the social brain, because humans are such social creatures. And merely hearing the footfalls of others activates that part of the brain as well. We're astonishingly sensitive to the footfalls of others because these signal important things to us. And we recognize each other's footfalls. You know who is approaching you based on the sound of the way they walk. And they know you as well, if they know you well at all. So we have brains that are really remarkably attuned in all sorts of subtle and not so subtle ways to the walking of others, because this is how humans conquered the world. We spread out all over the world without mechanization. Remember, you know, the spread all over Europe, the spread into Russia, into Siberia, down through North America, into South America, was all done before the car came along. We did this on foot. We did it with animals, you know, so we brought cows along, or horses, or chickens, or whatever it happened to be. But that's how we did it. We did it in groups, and that's how we populated the world. And to be together effectively in groups, we need to be very, very well attuned to all of the other members of that group. And of course, we also need to be able to tell if the footfalls that we're hearing in the distance are friend or foe. Yeah. Do we hide, or should we go out and shake hands? If you make the wrong decision, you're in trouble.
How persuasive can you be by telling people why and specifically how walking is good for you? I just wonder how to really get people moving. Are the reasons persuasive enough?
I don't know. You know, we'll have to come back and revisit this conversation in a year or two, I guess. But what I would say is that if you build more walking into the course of your everyday life, and this is what this book is really about. It's not about the benefits of going off for a hike on a trail once a year. It's for getting moving during the course of your everyday life. It will reveal things to you that were previously hidden, and you will feel yourself better in ways that you had not previously appreciated that you could do. And, of course, it will help extend your life by keeping you healthier for much longer than you would otherwise have been. That's good for you, good for your family, good for society at large. Day in, day out. That's what we're built for. And that's what we can adapt to very, very easily. But we've used our big brains to engineer a bit of laziness out of our, or into our lives. We need to engineer it back out. And I'll give you a simple example. If I want to get to the stairs to walk to my office, I have to go through three fire doors. If I want to take the elevator, it's just in front of me. That's a default design by the architect to make it easy to move units of human flesh about. A different building design would insist that when you come in, you have to take the stairs. And that extra movement, of course, would be good for you. It shouldn't be difficult, but the default in the environment very often is that you are passively transported when what we should be doing, being actively transported.
Shane O'Mara is the author of In Praise of Walking, The New Science of How We Walk and Why It's Good for Us. BYU Radio invites you to join with us and other listeners in 10,000 acts of service. We still have a couple weeks to reach our goal, and you can join in the effort by performing any type of service, large or small. For great ideas, we encourage you to go to justserve.org. It's an online resource where you can discover volunteer opportunities right in your own zip code. Justserve.org. If you'd landed in America as the expat child of Soviet Jews, you might benefit from a little chutzpah. Like if you've got a screenplay about your grandmother and you bump into Hillary Clinton at a conference, you might try to persuade her to put you in touch with Steven Spielberg.
I take my chances everywhere they come. My husband makes fun of me a lot. He says it's not realistic. And I say, well, one can dream. And so there are sometimes amazing synchronicities that happen because I take those chances. And I've learned from just little things happening that you always have to try because you'll regret not trying. It may come to nothing, but it may come to something.
Why not? We'll meet a gutsy Soviet expat and a puppy named Pushkin next on Constant Wonder.